Kretzmann, and let me just say a word or two about my own background and biases that I bring to thinking about this set of questions, and then kind of use the morning to try out some ideas that we're working on back east, as they say out here these days. The major bias to tell you about that I come to these questions with is that I'm a city person. Almost everything that I think about, almost any issue, gets sort of filtered through the lens of cities. I grew up near Chicago, went to school out east, and was a reporter for a while in New York City, really got to love New York, and then about 23 years ago moved to Chicago and have been working in, doing organizing in, doing policy work in neighborhoods and communities of Chicago and teaching about Chicago and writing some about cities for the last 22 or 23 years. So almost everything I think about poverty and about race and about the challenges of life in the United States in the late 20th century, for me, gets filtered through cities. Partly it gets filtered through cities, I suppose, because for me, cities contain virtually every other category, places where almost everything intersects and interacts in vibrant ways. So for me, it's not that much of a limitation to admit to you that I look at everything through the lenses of cities. When I talk about people who have their focus on only one kind of lens, which is what I am these days, this summer anyway, am reminded let me just share one brief story with you. I like the sports pages a lot, and I often find wisdom in the sometimes unthought out commentary provided by athletes, particularly baseball players. And my favorite commentary this summer by a baseball player was by a fellow named Louis Polonia. Louis Polonia was an outfielder for the New York Yankees who got traded to California Angels, and the Los Angeles Press interviewed him on his first day about what life was like with the turbulent Yankees. The Yankees are having a lot of problems, for those of you who are not baseball fans. And Louis Polonia thought for a minute, and then he said, "You know, those Yankees, they only have one thing on their mind, and I don't know what that is." Somehow that has captured a lot of life for me this summer. Ingrid and I think that about our 13-year-old daughter sometimes. She'll have a clue what the one thing
is.
So every time I sort of have to admit now that I'm monofocused on urban stuff, I think about Lewis and what he's taught us. At least I know what it is that I'm focused on. What I want to do today, then, out of that focus, is to share some work and thinking that we're doing out of our Chicago base, trying to learn some of the lessons of the last three decades of experience of people working on the question of poverty in the United States, particularly. Let me just begin very briefly by, I don't have to do much of that, this, partly because Ed and Sarah Naylor are around doing an awful lot of this, but let me just remind you where we are in terms of poverty these days, in case anybody in this room needs any reminding. Let me just do this very briefly, because Ed and Sarah are doing a terrific job of it. I just put up a couple of quick reminders on the board here called an overview of poverty. The basic message is that after a few decades of progress, both globally and in the United States, we're now regressing. We're now losing any kind of war or skirmish that we've been engaged in terms of poverty. Globally, economists talk about what they call absolute poverty. The definition that most people use when they're thinking about poverty on a global scale is that. What absolute poverty means is that people are unable to get food, shelter, or clothing. Food, shelter, or clothing, any one of those three. sort of defines you as part of absolute poverty. And of course, it's devastating globally. The numbers at the moment are something like 1.2 billion. It's very hard to count. Something like 23.4% of the world's population, something around 5 billion total. We're talking about absolutely immense set of challenges globally. Just a brief word globally about who the poor are. Interestingly enough, only a fifth of the poor globally are urban. Only a fifth are urban. That makes me stretch my imagination a little bit in terms of stretching my city focus a little. But that number, a fifth of the poor globally, is rising precipitously each year. Still, though, about four-fifths are rural. About 55% of the poor globally are women. And most startling, for me, I think, is that two-thirds of the poor globally are under 15 years old. Right? We're talking about just millions and millions of children in poverty and growing up into poverty situations. It's interesting to put some of the United States numbers next to the global numbers, and to think about the different things that we mean by poverty. And this is tricky. We're not talking, for the most part, in the United States, the kind of absolute poverty definition that people use globally. By that definition, there are virtually, probably under a million poor people in the United States. But that doesn't make any sense definitionally, because poverty is partly defined in that kind of absolute sense, but it's partly defined, and very importantly, just as importantly, in a relative sense. That is, relative to what the society has, relative to what the economy has that you're embedded in, where are you? Do you have what it takes in that society to move into the mainstream of the society? By those kinds of numbers, the government at this point, which is always pretty conservative with these numbers, the government thinks that for a family of four in the United States to exist at some kind of bare minimum level, it takes something like $12,092 per year. By that count, there's something like 31.7 million, or about 15% poverty rate in the United States. If you think about a family of four on 12,000, and think about the cost of housing, the cost of food, the cost of transportation, we're not talking about a very high standard of living. A foundation in Washington, D.C. called the Family Foundation just last month completed a study that they've done over the last year where they've interviewed a whole lot of folks across the country and asked, what are the really absolute minimum basics that people can get along on in the United States and have some kind of sort of floor level of existence. And then they added up the costs of what people told them was a minimum standard of living. And their number was $15,017. So still at an absolute minimum, but at least based on a somewhat more on a set of conversations about what Americans think is an absolute minimum, $15,000 a year for a family of four. And by that count, we've got about 45 million poor people in the United States. Who are the poor in the United States? There are lots of ways to think about that. One way is that they divide into thirds, sort of. A third are elderly and disabled. And interestingly enough, over the last 20 years or so, things have gotten slightly better for people in that category, not precipitously better, but a little bit better. One third are a category that the economists call temporary poor, that is people who are in any given year in and out of poverty. That category is growing in the United States, partly because we've got a larger and larger number of working poor with a larger and larger number of jobs that don't pay enough to be able to reach the $12,000 minimum for a family. So the temporary poor, people who are right on the edge and topple into it and then sort of get out of it, topple into it again, is a growing category. And of course, the fastest growing category over the last 15 years is the category of the permanent poor. We really didn't used to have anything like the numbers of permanently poor. That is, people who, over a period of more than 3 years, have been categorized as poor, permanently locked out, it looks like, of the mainstream economy. Okay. Last thing to say just about this overview is I put two lines on here. The global line is the brown line, and the United States line is the green line, about that have to do with the poverty rate over the last 40 years, starting in 50. If you look, they're remarkably similar in their shape, although the U.S. line has a little bit more variation in it. The brown line shows that starting at about a 30% poverty rate in 1950 globally, we got it down in 1980 to 22%. And in the decade of the 80s, global poverty is creeping back up, so that by 1990, we're back up at 23.4%. A gradual re-increase, not only in the absolute numbers of poor people, but in the percentage of poor people. In the United States, the drop in the poverty rate was even more precipitous. And this is particularly interesting when you think about all of the sort of government bashing that has gone on about the programs in the 1960s and 70s, the War on Poverty, the Great Society, and so forth, and the rejection of that by the Reagan administration in the 1980s. But clearly, that those programs, combined with a full employment economy, or close to it around the Vietnam War, reduced poverty to about 11%. That was in the year we got to there was, I think, 1973, 1974. And then since that time, the poverty rate in the United States has been escalating again too. It flattened out actually for a while until the recession in the early 80s. And since then, it's been growing again. So the upshot of all of that is that we may have been learning some things about how to reduce poverty, about how to get people back into the mainstream of the economy in the 60s and 70s. Whatever it was we learned then, we forgot about around the mid-1970s or 1980s, and we've been backsliding ever since. It seems to me that, are the figures clear? Yes?
When you were saying about some of these jobs, they're not even making, when I was up here the last time, I had the opportunity to, when I got back, to look into this job at a quote, at a sewing machine factory, and I never heard about the job, but then I looked at it, that I would make less and I would lose my whole SSI, and I don't know what happened, but I never went to work.
Sure.
So I made the decision not to, and I'm in a much better situation than if I had to work.
Sure.
So
because
I'm,
none of the incentives sort
now
of
I'm in
pulls
a position
the
to
job.
Wait for the job at the school, where I might have to wait a long time, but I'm in a position I can wait to get
interesting,
what I
want. Yeah. I think you're not alone. I think there are lots of people for whom it doesn't pay to work. That's what you're describing, right?
Yeah.
There are an awful lot of reasons. I want to talk a little bit about that, because it seems to me some of the incentive kinds of systems that we've set up for folks in this country just don't make any sense at this point. Yeah.
The one, or let's see, two-thirds under 15. Seems to mean to me that if they have parents, their parents would be poor also.
That's right.
So a good number of those are orphans or children of single parents.
We're also talking about a lot of third world situations where it still makes economic sense to have very large families. So people choose to have lots and lots of children, knowing that many of them will die, and that for the economic survival of the family, it makes sense to have quite a few of them, so that there will be enough folks to bring in at least bread to eat. So we're talking very large families. Augusta?
No, that was my question, the two-thirds under 15.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if that was SEMA.
Yeah, I think that you know, one of the things we've certainly learned about development is that it really it's at a certain point that is well above survival that people begin having smaller families, that the economic incentives to have lots of children are still there and still make absolute sense for lots and lots of poor people. And it's a little difficult for us to question, it seems to me, why they do that. Yeah, Eric?
This might be jumping ahead. But do you have the figures on what percentage of children are living in poverty in this country, and is that number on the increase?
Yes, the number is on the increase. Let's see. The only notes I've got on that, Eric, at the moment is that, interestingly enough, that almost one-fourth of all United States children are now poor. And that's way up. So the number of women and children in poverty, we can take another look at the U.S. numbers and see precipitous rises in the number of women and the number of children in poverty. So that almost a quarter now of our children are born into poverty. Well, it seems to me we don't need to belabor these numbers, and I do think that Ed and Sarah Naylor in particular and others this week are doing a lot to lay out the scope of the problem. And the other thing I don't need to do very much today, I don't think, with you all in this room, is to reiterate the source of our collective commitment and faith that calls us into dealing with this question. It seems to me that we need go no further than the example of Jesus in the Gospels to remind ourselves who Jesus ate with, who he cared about, who, as the Latin Americans tell us, he had a preferential option for. And that sort of pull into work on these questions seems to be absolutely unquestionable. I'm just going to assume that. Can I just assume that? Is that okay, Bishop? All right. So let me then turn to what it is we're thinking about as we look particularly at the United States. And I'll circle back to the global scene because we're thinking about some stuff in terms of U.S. poverty now that I think we've been taught by people who are working in the third world. Let me ask you first then to imagine yourself in this setting. Imagine yourself in a job with a boss with whom you don't get along really well. And your requirement in this job, every morning at 7 o'clock, is to come into work and to go into your boss's office and to tell your boss all of the things that you have done wrong over the last 24 hours. All of the problems you've encountered. All of the ways in which you've screwed up your life in the last 24 hours. And that you've got a full, your requirement is every morning to have an absolutely full list of every problem in your life. That's the way your workday starts. And you don't get your paycheck until your boss is satisfied that your list is bad enough. Right? That you have convinced your boss that you are such a screw-up in your life that you really need the money. Right? Can you put yourself into that situation? Hard to put yourself in that situation, isn't it?
Is that real?
Well, let's see if it's real. I think what I'd like to argue is that willy-nilly over the last 25 years in the United States, that's essentially the position that we've put poor people into. That what I just described as an interpersonal interaction at the beginning of a work day is in fact what we ask poor folks to do all the time. And what we particularly ask whole poor neighborhoods to do in the city. What I'm talking about here is something that I suppose we could call a needs paradigm. That is a way of understanding the world, or at least a way of understanding the world of poor people, which defines that world entirely in terms of needs and deficiencies and problems. That's what poor people are, and that's what they have. Right? A couple of quick examples. Probably one of the best recent economic analyses of urban poverty and the new underclass is Bill Wilson, William Julius Wilson, the head of sociology department at the University of Chicago, a brilliant black sociologist who has really tried to understand the economic dynamics that have locked out poor folks in particularly poor African American communities. This is a marvelous book in lots of ways. But think about the way in which the Reagan administration language has shaped Bill Wilson's title. The title is The Truly Disadvantaged, the inner city, the underclass, and public policy. So what we're about in the post-Reagan years is trying to determine how truly disadvantaged people are, right? How absolutely, abjectly needful people are. Even the best of sociologists are doing it. Since the public sector and government shrank so much, beginning in the late 1970s and through the 1980s, one of the sets of institutions that has entered into the void left by government is a set of institutions known as foundations, private foundations. Big ones, Ford and Carnegie and others, have done more in the last 12 or 15 years to sort of shape policy thinking at the national level than any other set of institutions I know. The Ford Foundation these days, some of you might know this, is pushing a major report that came out a few months ago, actually late last year, called The Common Good, Social Welfare in the American Future. This is an interesting and I think in lots of ways helpful report. It details some of what we're talking about here in terms of poverty in the United States, tends to do it in terms of the life cycle, talks about children, talks about youth, talks about working age people and retirement age people, and argues that all of them are having problems, particularly poor folks in each of those ages of the life cycle, but defines the world, once again, in terms of needs and problems and deficiencies, and asks for policies that address needs and problems and deficiencies. Now, I think that that's a major strand of thinking that almost everybody falls into naturally. When you run that line of thinking through the places that mostly I've worked over the last 20 or 25 years, that is low-income neighborhoods, with people in low-income neighborhoods, I want to show you what I think we get. I have a little visual aid here. Eric, can you help me put this up? We've been working on creating sort of maps of a neighborhood. This is a map of what a low-income neighborhood looks like through the eyes of the Ford Foundation, right? Or through the eyes of people who think about the needs paradigm. We're calling this a neighborhood needs map. Just a map of a neighborhood. This is a pretty simple idea here that I want to mess around with for a little bit. Think about a low-income neighborhood in the city. I hope this will expand beyond that particular setting too. A low-income neighborhood. Can you see that? Does the light shine through?
It's fine.
Okay. What is a low-income neighborhood? What are the people in low-income neighborhoods about? They are bundles of incredibly difficult problems, right? There's illiteracy and unemployment and lead poisoning and gangs and mental illness and crime and drug abuse and rat bites. I like maps that have rat bites on them. Alcoholism, slum housing all over the place, boarded up buildings, child abuse, homelessness. The requirement, if you are in a low-income community and you want to work in a low-income community to work on questions of poverty, the requirement is that you get up in the morning and you tell your boss how bad things are. The first thing you do is you get up in the morning and you do a needs survey, right? If you can paint the picture of illiteracy starkly enough to get the attention of the right foundation executive or the right church executive or the right government official, you will then get a grant to help you address that need, right? Is that right, Ron? That's the way you do it?
Well, yes. Our problem is the opposite. You can't tell them the good story because they won't give you the money.
Absolutely. And poor people are the only people in the United States that we do this to. Tell us the worst possible story you can about your life and about your neighborhood, and then we'll give you money. Then and only then will we give you money. Or then and only then will we give you something. It might not be money all the time, right? It could be services, for instance. Okay, I think that this is the reigning paradigm. I think this is what we do with poor people in the United States. I think it began in the New Deal. I think it escalated in the War on Poverty in the 1960s and the Great Society programs. I think lots of those programs did a lot of good, but I think that one of the legacies that we have of those programs are a set of bureaucracies and a set of approaches to these questions that are locked in to the needs paradigm. All right? When you look at low-income neighborhoods or the question of poverty through the needs paradigm, it seems to me what you see is a definition of poverty that's really quite strange. That poverty no longer means that people are without money, right? Certainly one for fairly simple, that's sort of what we were dealing with over there, without income of some kind. Or people are without power, that seems to me another defensible definition of poverty. But that poverty instead means that people are without the right attributes, right? People somehow need to clean up their act. And one of the ways they can clean up their act is with our help, with the help of service providers, with the help of welfare workers, with the help of mental health care workers, with the help of counselors of all stripes. So that in fact, when you think about what this neighborhood is, it's a large set of opportunities for middle class welfare workers. Right? And it's a set of locked doors for the poor folk. Let me give you one quick example. We, a couple years ago, spent time with friends, and all of this stuff is not stuff that I'm sort of thinking up here. It really is, it's about years of conversations with folks who are working in and living in and struggling in neighborhoods, mostly in Chicago, who are my teachers, and I have to keep saying that over and over again. We work with some folks on the west side of Chicago, in a very poor African-American neighborhood, to think about all of the government programs that came into one neighborhood. Sort of take a look at that, where the money was. And what we found was, and with sort of very conservative numbers, that there was about, in this one neighborhood, there was money that if you divided it up among every poor person, every man, woman, and child in poverty, you would have about the equivalent of $6,000 of government money coming in, $6,000 per poor person coming into that neighborhood. Okay? Now think about that for a family of four. We're talking about there the possibility of an income of $24,000, which is above either the family foundation or about twice what the government estimate is of the poverty floor. Well, you know the caveat, you know the trick here, right? $6,000 comes in from the government to one neighborhood, $6,000 per poor person. What happens to that money? Two-thirds of that money goes to in the pockets of service professionals, right? And one-third as income in the pockets of poor people. So in terms of income, what you're dealing then with is about $2,000 per person coming into that neighborhood. And the other $4,000 per person goes into the pockets of service providers. Of that two-thirds, interestingly enough, almost two-thirds was medical services. Almost two-thirds had to do with the provision of medical care for people in the community. It came in as Medicare and Medicaid money.
Just a minute, so, for the people who are providing the services or those who need
them? All Medicare and Medicaid money goes to institutions. Goes to doctors and nurses.
I hear.
Medical care providers. Doesn't go to folk.
Right? Okay.
It's not income.
Got it.
It seems to us, and it seems to the people that we're dealing with all the time, that there's really no possibility of breaking out of the poverty trap with this kind of model. with this kind of paradigm. Now, I'm oversimplifying a little bit, but I'm really trying to think with people about whether or not there's an alternative way of thinking about how you would break out of a low-income neighborhood. Not out of the neighborhood, but out of poverty in the neighborhood. So what is the alternative? Let me just share briefly. One of the sort of simple-minded routes our thinking is sort of going this time. Let's try this. Eric, can you? One alternative way of thinking about low-income neighborhoods is to focus, rather than on needs, on assets, on capacities, and to think about poor people in the same way that we think about each other. Right? I have a set of colleagues where I am now at Northwestern University who are absolute candidates for this needs paradigm. I mean, they're terrible people. They are professors who drink too much and who eat too much and could use all the counseling help I could give them. These are my colleagues I'm talking about at Northwestern University. But if I want the Center for Urban Affairs where I work to function smoothly, I pretty much don't deal with that side of them. I deal with their capacities. I deal with what their abilities are. I deal with what they've got to give. Right? This is a simple suggestion that maybe we could do that with poor people. That maybe we could think about low-income neighborhoods as collections, still, even devastated though they are, as collections of people with capacities, with gifts to give, with assets to share. So this is alternative one. This is a neighborhood assets map. We've been thinking through with neighborhoods, mostly in Chicago, but in other places as well. Let me just go through it briefly and then give you a couple quick examples. We've got this sort of coded. We're thinking with people in neighborhoods about, well, what do you got? What's here that we can build on, right? The green in the middle are a beginning list of what is in any low-income neighborhood that is, one, located in the neighborhood, and two, controlled pretty much by the people who live in the neighborhood. So location and control are the two variables, all right? Then we've got a few things in red around the edges of that. Police, vacant land, social service agencies, energy and waste, higher education, public schools, libraries. These are institutions which are often located in low-income neighborhoods, but are seldom under the control of the people in low-income neighborhoods. So the question there is, how might people in low-income neighborhoods get control over institutions that are in their neighborhoods and turn them toward neighborhood rebuilding? And finally, there are a few things listed on the outside of the map in blue, public information, capital improvement, welfare, and so on, that are both located out of the neighborhood and under the control of outsiders, right? So the challenge is a little bit more in terms of people using these as assets to rebuild neighborhoods. Well, let me just say a few things about give you a couple of examples of where this kind of work leads in contrast to where this kind of approach to neighborhoods leads. And I'm not sure necessarily whether this is going to whether this kind of approach is going to begin to influence people beyond the sort of city level in some cities. I do know that it's an approach which seems to really resonate with folks in neighborhoods, and that's pretty important to me. We're working with people in all of these areas. Let me give you just a couple of examples. One of the things that we've been doing is to think about poor people even in neighborhoods where the unemployment rate is skyrocketing, 40, 50, even 55, 60%, to think with folks about all of the things that poor people can do. Right? So we've worked with a number of neighborhood organizations to develop a capacity inventory of individuals So that instead of a welfare worker knocking on the door of a single mother and asking about how many kids and how sick they are, how many needs she's got, right? The interview is about capacities. The interview is about trying to figure out what folks can do. The interview is about making people think about their lives in a way that highlights for them all of the skills they've got. And then, hopefully, leading them to thinking about how you make money off that, how you start enterprises, or how you get into either a training or job situation with that. So a lot of the work on this stuff begins with capacity inventories, begins with thinking with people about both their own individual and institutional kinds of inventories. Seeing gifts of people where often we see only problems. One other story here about gifts of labeled people. That's a sort of funny little category to have up in the middle of this. One of the women who's involved working with this project at this point is working in a low-income, mostly Hispanic neighborhood in Chicago. And what she has done is, with no contact at all, she's an ex sort of social service counselor type, who's sort of reformed from that point of view. And what she does is she has found about 50 people who are severely mentally or physically challenged, but whose family roots are in that community and who had been institutionalized elsewhere, right? There are a variety of institutions around the city and even outside the city where these folks have been sort of warehoused away. And she's simply gotten to know by now about 50 of those folks. And she's also gotten to know her neighbors in this neighborhood, the Logan Square neighborhood. And all she's doing is matching them up. She's reintegrating labeled people into the life of the community. Simple, simple, simple idea. So that she's got an old Polish guy who's about 70 probably, whose IQ is probably around 45 or 50, whose only possession in his dark room in the corner of the institution where he was warehoused, his only possession was an old bowling ball. Nobody had ever seen him bowl before, but they knew that he sort of occasionally carried this bowling ball around. So what happened was that Nancy got to know him, and some of his little conversation was about bowling. And he is now, to make a nice set of interactions very short, he is now the seventh member of a six-member all-Hispanic bowling team, none of whom speak English or Polish, but they have all sort of incorporated this guy into the life of their bowling team, and they bowl three nights a week, and he's now part of all six families of these guys who are on his bowling team, and he goes there for Christmas and Easter and birthdays and weddings and so forth, and is constantly a part of the community at this point, and this bowling team, therefore, has become a kind of sort of ongoing community center, right, for these families and for this guy. So there are 50 of stories like that, of labeled people back in the community. And one of the things that's done is because that took place under the umbrella of the local community organization, it has changed the self-definition of the community. So when the community gets together now, and there are big congresses with 800 or 1,000 people coming together and saying, you know, let's march on City Hall for this, or let's get this done in the housing area, or let's get this done with the police. There is also now a part of every meeting where the community organization says, who are we as a community? We are a community of hospitality. We're a community that reaches out, that cares for its own, that won't allow institutions to take our own people away from us. That's worth fighting for. Therefore, let's go beat up the mayor. Get whatever we need, right? So there's a sense of identity of rebuilding community that comes out, it seems to us, of focusing on gifts and assets rather than needs. One or two quick stories on the red category out here. Schools are so important in Chicago at this point. It's the most exciting stuff going on in Chicago. Public schools in low-income neighborhoods are often, as all of you know, battlegrounds. Problem areas, magnets for drugs, the best people, most of the best people who were involved in public schools always asked the question, what can you in the community do for the school? Now that seems to us to be a question that's asked out of a set of blinders, out of a set of sort of institutional blinders. What can the community do for the school? So we've been asking, what if you reversed that and saw schools as assets for community building, for community development? So basically what we're doing now is, with some Chicago schools, is thinking with them about how they can become engines for economic development in the neighborhood, how they can become employers of local folks, how they can become places where all of the cafeteria food is provided by local folks, many of whom are wonderful folks, right? How they can begin to regard themselves as sources of jobs, right? As 24-hour-a-day community centers, as places where the community gathers to redefine itself. So we've got a whole school participation and local economic development kind of project going on in Chicago at this point. There are other possibilities, it seems to me, for thinking, rethinking social service agencies, police, parks, libraries, and so on, as assets for rebuilding communities. Not as institutions that are important just for themselves, although it's clearly important what goes on in a school or a library, but as assets for rebuilding the community. Let me finally just say a couple of things about these outside categories. Welfare expenditures, for instance. Just a story or two. It does seem to us possible to think with people about how you would begin to divert some of the welfare money that comes into a neighborhood so that it's actually controlled by local folks and contributes to rebuilding communities. One quick story. Medicaid money, which comes into any low-income community, is substantial. The Medicaid money that was targeted in one low-income community on the west side of Chicago, that was targeted for reduction of infant mortality, right, for services to particularly young mothers, young pregnant women, that stream of money. We got an agreement with both Washington and Springfield, the state capital, to take a portion of that money and to give it to a local community organization to see what they would do with it. The story is, briefly, what they did with it was they hired a whole bunch of local people, friends of pregnant mothers, of pregnant young women, people who were in the community. And those, mostly young women, became a core of home visiting, health care advisors, nutrition advisors, purveyors of the simplest kind of information to young pregnant women. The result is, I still find this remarkable. After 4 years of doing this, the infant mortality rate has been reduced from 33 per 1,000 live births to 17 per 1,000 live births. Cut in half, almost cut in half. And the only difference is, in fact, 95% of the money was all we asked for this particular experiment. So it saved the government money. We took 95% of what they would otherwise spend on professional services, gave it to the community to design their own kind of problem, their own kind of approach to it, and the infant mortality rate has been reduced by that much. At the same time, providing jobs for about 25, mostly women who otherwise wouldn't have jobs. Where was this? It's a West Side community in Chicago, Garfield Park. The same possibilities, it seems to us, there are a lot of other possibilities, it seems to us, under the welfare category, but capital improvements. I mean, if you think about, this gets a little complicated because I don't want to spend too much time. If you think about downtowns of cities have billions and billions of dollars poured into them, public money, every time a new hotel goes up or every time a new department store goes in, right? And the public money that goes into downtowns, Chicago, my town, has a gleaming downtown at this point. So is Seattle and lots of other towns. Their downtowns have come back. The reason they've come back is that the public money that gets poured into downtowns gets poured in a development mode. That is, it gets poured in because it gets private money in. It creates jobs, right? It builds the downtown. Nobody thinks about neighborhoods in a development mode. Everybody thinks about neighborhoods, particularly low-income neighborhoods, at best in a kind of maintenance mode. If the sidewalks get too bad, we've got to fix them or people are going to break their legs, right? If the fire station's falling over completely, we've got to probably put some new ramshackle thing up. But there's no reason, it seems to us, that you can't think about low-income neighborhoods and capital expenditures in low-income neighborhoods as vehicles for developing the neighborhood, right? Not just maintaining people in the absence of work. So that's what we're just sort of playing around here with folks who are desperate. We're desperate, I think. Those of us who are involved in thinking about the ever worsening poverty scenes that we're in touch with every day. The urgent call, I think, is for some kind of invention, some kind of way to instill a little bit of hope, both in folks in the community, and I think increasingly in folks like us, who are not necessarily directly in the community. Let me say one more thing that about the process that we're trying to work with in a number of different communities. Once you've got this kind of asset map in mind, the question is, who does this? Who might develop this kind of community? We can say a lot more about this, but mostly we've been working with classic community organizations, classic, back east there's a lot in San Francisco and Los Angeles. I'm not sure how much there is of this tradition in the Northwest. But the classic so-called Alinsky-style community organization that assembles all of the power in a neighborhood and classically goes after City Hall or goes after the bank to get investments back in the neighborhood, goes after somebody outside to help out a low-income neighborhood. The problem is that for lots of cities and lots of low-income neighborhoods, the outside doesn't have any resources anymore, right? You can't, why beat up on City Hall when City Hall doesn't have any money? Why go after a bank for mortgages when the bank is owned by somebody in England? You know, or some global corporation which doesn't have any interest at all in development of Chicago or Tacoma or wherever. So we're saying that the local community organization might rethink itself as what we're now calling an asset development organization. How do you think about yourself as an asset development organization? The other outfit that lots of poor neighborhoods have that might be appropriate to this kind of work is the local community development corporation. That is the outfit in the neighborhood, not the one that deals with the issues, that's the community organization, but many neighborhoods have local community development, economic development corporations, which have concentrated really on job creation and sort of small business support, but could easily begin to incorporate some of this community building emphasis. And finally, none of this is to say that this is enough. None of this is to say that the quest for new resources to address poverty is not crucially important. I think it's terrifically important to work on the conversion question, to work on the possibility of a peace dividend, on some kinds of new resource flows to come into cities. But I am equally convinced that if those resource flows come in the same old way, through the same old bureaucracies, the same old institutions, that they're not going to be helpful in terms of breaking the poverty cycle. And I'm just convinced that most poor people see it that way too. But I think it is possible to learn from some of the stuff that's worked and hasn't worked in the past, and to rethink some directions for low-income neighborhoods that do have some possibilities this time.
Jody?
Yeah?
As I listen to this, I think about what was said last night about the war trap. I guess I'll just use that term. the poverty trap. It sounds as though poverty is needed for people who are benefiting from it, the jobs that are there. People need those jobs now, so they need poverty. Same as the war situation. We're trapped into that. So how do you see, is there a strategy in the people's mind, the ones who develop the neighborhood asset map, in penetrating that? What would be the first step in getting a rethinking, restructuring that whole economic little corner there of people who need those jobs? What's the first step? Do you know what I mean? How do you break through that? This is good.
Mm-hmm.
It's ideal. Right now, I don't know how realistic it is, because I don't know how much has been done with it.
Mm-hmm.
And how much ground has been covered.
These are all ideas in early process at this point, Leona.
Early process.
Yeah.
So I'm just like wondering what's next.
Okay.
One of the things that is being done in Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
Is kind of looking at the asset and having, instead of the, you know, when you're talking about the social services people saying, well, what are your needs, you know, going to what are the assets. I'm a real estate broker, and one of the things that we, you know, as a small business and in a town that's just, we're becoming a bedroom community for the Twin Cities. It was a rural community, and it's now becoming a bedroom community. That we had this work very well in our office, and I know other people's do, so, you know, I've got firsthand experience with it. A program is it's a work study, but also a work placement program that works very well. And the people that are in these programs are displaced homemakers, or in our case it was a person who had gone through a chemical dependency, family counseling type thing, and she had been, because she had raised 8 children, had been out of the workforce for several years. But she had a lot of, you know, let's find out what your assets are. She had a willingness to work. She had a willingness to learn. She wanted to do something.
Mm-hmm.
We had a need as a small business, just expanding, that we needed to have a receptionist secretarial position added, but didn't, because of the small business, didn't necessarily have the extra assets
sure.
at that point to hire it. So this program, and I don't remember what, you know, the whole great big fancy name to it, but in essence what it does was, for 6 months, she came into our office and we trained her in, and they paid 50% of her salary. So it was a win-win situation. She learned, because we had a position filled, she had on the job training.
So now is your real estate business in the community where she
yes,
lives?
Yes.
So you would, okay.
Right.
Yeah.
But then, and then the trade-off was that we had to assure them that, you know, and there was of course probationary, make sure that she fit in and we fit with her and everything. But after that 6 month period, she had to remain for at least 6 months with our company, or we had to pay back that 50%.
Mm-hmm.
She's been with us for 2 years, and we wouldn't do without her. You know, we love it. And if this worked like that, you know, something like that is something that I know that it's being used throughout Minnesota whenever possible, and it's really working well.
Yeah, that's exciting. One of the problems, the classic problems with job training, is that there's no connection often between the training and an available job, right? And this
right.
is a program
but
that
this,
matches
they
those
work
things.
With especially
yeah.
small businesses and
yeah.
smaller community, neighborhood type. I mean, this is in a rural community, but it's being used in the inner cities and different.
Sure.
Different. I guess what's exciting is that it's being used in every type of community throughout the state of Minnesota.
Great.
And you know what, the topography and the economics and everything of Minnesota, it's a chance to try it out in a big city, in a smaller rural city,
mm-hmm.
and in the different
sounds areas. Promising. Yes, Ben.
A couple of points
back in the
related
section,
the same to both of these. there's always been some resistance on my part in business to expand the definition of my job to include being my brother's keeper. My training didn't include that. And a lot of times it's hard to imagine it being a moneymaker. But it, at least it would be a public relations thing. And one thing that excites me a little bit about this would be to get the poverty people that I come in contact with to think about themselves as people with assets. Because I think almost totally they don't think of themselves that way. And that would be a beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wanted to kind of piggyback on what Bill said. As I hear this, and I've been battling with this thought for a period of time, it almost sounds like to me that this whole poverty syndrome, it almost sounds like to me that it was an intentional, strategic plan that had to be played out in order to provide wealth and to maintain a certain level of money for upper class people. And I think with that, it has exacerbated racism, because what do you hear? Those poor blacks, those poor Hispanics, they don't know what to do. They don't have enough sense to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. And what do you see on TV when you see poverty? You see, you know, poor black kids or poor Hispanic kids, those poor people. And I think it also exacerbates sexism, mm-hmm. you know, with this continual flash of single mothers on welfare. And I hate to think of it that way, but the longer I think about this and the more information I get, it's almost like it was, it's been a game plan, almost a conspiracy. Because there's just a certain amount of people that can be wealthy, you know what I'm saying? There's just a certain amount of people that can be wealthy and can be in power. So what are you going to do with all those other folks?
Yeah. I think another way of saying what you're saying is that poverty is structural.
Right.
That it has to do with fundamental structures in the economy.
Mm-hmm. And racism has to.
And racism absolutely
has to
is
be.
A central part mm-hmm. of that mechanism. Mm-hmm. I think what this is an attempt to both to rethink how to rethink the image of poor people, mm-hmm. right? So you right. don't think about that when you think necessarily about, for instance, public housing developments, right? Mm-hmm. That's an image that comes to mind. Mm-hmm. But anybody who's worked in public housing developments knows that there's an awful lot of awfully good people mm-hmm. struggling to make a life, right. you know, that are working on this kind of model. There. How to lift that up and how to build policy on that is the real question we're working on here.
When she mentioned about the program where where you had for 6 months where someone else pays half the salary, when I think about it, maybe this is what happened with this job, because they would have had to guarantee me working it for 6 months. So maybe that was what...
I see, yeah.
But, you know, it...
Yeah.
It was just meant to me. If I had went to work there, I would let go of my Social Security, and I would be making $300 less.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean...
One other lesson I wanted to sort of underline here. It seems to me clear that increased funds from outside, whether from government or business or any place else, it is something we have absolutely learned in the third world over the last 15 years. Those funds will be used much more effectively if they come into an area where folks have already got some structures of their own, some plans of their own, some developments of their own, some ways to control those resources and put them toward the community development uses, right? We've let the good people who are doing international development have learned that all over the globe. We have been incredibly slow, it seems to me, to apply those lessons to United States poverty. And it's partly because of racism, I think. We have not been able to get our blinders off to understand that if we want to give aid effectively, that aid depends on there being the capacity of local folks to use it well.
You know, it comes to mind, the difference between that, the needs and the assets, is a phrase that we've heard, and I know it works because I grew up in this, that poor is an attitude and broke is a temporary situation. Temporary might mean 50 years, but it's temporary. You know, I know now, looking back, when I was a little girl, my mom and dad didn't have much money, and I didn't know that they were receiving welfare. But it was like, this is a temporary situation to get us out of this. We've got things we can do, we can go. But if you're told constantly, tell me all your problems, and you don't have any work, you don't have any assets, how are you going to have any of an attitude? And it cuts racial lines. I mean, I've got a brother-in-law that still thinks he's poor. He could have $1 million and he'd be poor because of his attitude. And I think that, you know, those, the differences there really fit into that.
Yeah. I'm excited to see that there are some neighborhoods that are really progressing in terms of thinking about themselves in that way. Some of you know Bethel New Life on the west side of Chicago, a Lutheran, little Lutheran congregation that sank to 30 members in the 1960s when the neighborhood turned over like that from white to black, has rebuilt itself to about 600 or 800 members at this point, and runs this is Bethel Lutheran Church, is affiliated with a now $5 million a year kind of local development corporation, which employs something like 400 people, and thinks about ways, it's in a very, very poor African American community, thinks about all of the ways in which these assets can be leveraged. Some of you know this scene. Just story after story, it's one of the groups that we've worked closest with over the years, of creative ways to build on assets. They, for instance, they develop housing and they never do just one thing at a time. They're developing some new housing now, and every fifth house that they build is going to be built to